From PRI, Public Radio International.
Greep could swear that in his string of novels, nothing had been chipped out of his own past. Antoine, Thomas, Bertrand, and René, and by now Clément Didier, Laurent Hugues, and Yves, had arrived as strangers, almost like historical figures. At the same time, it seemed to Greep that their wavering, ruffled reflection should deliver something he alone could recognize. What did he see bending over the pond of his achievement?
You're listening to a great writer, Mavis Gallant, reading from her own story, Greep and Push. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series which originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Certain Selected Shorts evenings at Symphony Space will always live in my memory as literary and emotional high points. The night Raymond Carver introduced us to his three young protege authors, Tess Gallagher, Tobias Wolff, and Richard Ford. The night Doris Lessing read a magical story by Idris Shah. Or the night Nadine Gordimer brought the audience to a true standing, cheering ovation by presenting a program of South African short stories foreshadowing the end of apartheid. More recently, we were honored with an exceptionally rare visit from her home in Paris by the extraordinary Canadian-born writer Mavis Gallant. A number of literary luminaries gathered on stage at Symphony Space to pay tribute to Mavis Gallant, among them the poet Edward Hirsch and the writers Russell Banks, Michael Ondaatje, and Jhumpa Lahiri. Let's listen to Jhumpa Lahiri, the acclaimed fiction writer, talking about the master, Mavis Gallant.
I discovered the writing of Mavis Gallant 9 years ago. I was 30 years old and had begun to understand and accept that I was a writer of fiction. I imagine every writer reaches a moment when the act of putting words to paper changes from something that one wants to do to something one must, when desire gives way to a sense of duty, not to a reader or any other person, but purely to oneself. It was a sobering realization for me, one that reordered the components of my life. It is no mere coincidence that I began to devote myself to writing at the same time that I began to read Mavis Gallant. This was 1996, the same year the collected stories had been published. Around this time, I happened to find, at a book sale in my hometown library, a discarded copy of Home Truths, one of Mavis Gallant's previous collections, published in 1981. The first story I read, The Ice Wagon Going Down the Street, knocked me out of my chair, breaking something in me, something about what a story can do and how, and I pray I never recover. I had landed on a pinnacle, and I knew that it just didn't get any better. I was seized by the story's beauty, its urgency, its precision, and its intelligence, and the combination of these things still staggers me each time I read anything by Mavis Gallant. I have reread her more often than any other writer I know. She is like music that way. I read a story, I respond to it, and then I read it again and again, in different moods, in different seasons, sometimes in its entirety, sometimes just a part, growing increasingly familiar with the journey, never tiring of it, and always learning. Her work is inexhaustible, and by now it is as indispensable to my own work as my computer and my dictionary. She teaches me something I can never do myself, for to read her is to understand her exclusive hold over her characters and her meticulously crafted world. All great writers are inimitable, but there is an idiosyncrasy to Mavis Gallant's vision that distinguishes her from even the very finest in the pack. I think it has a lot to do with the way she describes her characters, an accumulation of detail plucked as if at random from a bush, converting sentences into a living being. But while other writers are content to pick at the surface, Mavis Gallant goes in, elbow deep, always at the center, always at the heart, yet never where I expect. Once encountered, these details, however subtle, stick like burrs. Such details give me access to a human soul that is so intimate, so intensely revelatory, that it feels sacred. When we visit her characters, We do not merely sit in their living rooms. We see their closets, their drawers filled with odds and ends, the stray objects under their beds. There is a wonderful paradox about reading Mavis Gallant, something that, as Shakespeare said of Cleopatra, makes hungry where most she satisfies. The stories, so vividly rendered, are vividly experienced in the process of reading, absorbing me utterly. But when I come to the end, they dissolve like dreams, the tight mosaic of scenes and images scattering, with the wonderful exception that I can turn to them again and again. Like dreams, they are a complex combination of perfect clarity and difficulty at the same time. She is unique in her sensibility, telling tales at once tragic and comic, composed of darkness and light. Most of literature tends to be one thing or the other, but Mavis Gallant straddles both hemispheres, indeed encompasses the whole world of fiction. Three things about Mavis Gallant are of enormous personal importance to me. The first is her devotion to the short story. As someone who continues to read and write short stories, I'm always grateful to Mavis Gallant for creating one of the most magnificent and elastic bodies of work in the form, for showing its boundless capacity. Many before me have remarked that her stories can do what novels do. I would like to do away with the comparison altogether and say for the record that her stories do everything, period. I would also like to say a bit about her subject matter and its relationship to my own work. I wrote most of the stories in my first book, Interpreter of Maladies, without having read any Mavis Gallant. I was not aware that I was writing about exiles, immigrants, displaced people of various kinds. It is only recently that I've grown conscious that so much of what I write about is connected, in this sense, to the great stories in that red and black book. She presents hybrids and misfits, people caught between languages, between cultures, between values. It has become popular now to talk about literature in terms of identity politics. Mavis Gallant shows us that this is nothing new, that not fully belonging or being one thing has always been an aspect of many people's lives. Of course, her stories are never about or in service to any idea. The facts of history, wars and genocides, and the movements of populations might inform her characters, but as is the case in all great works of art, the true subject of her work is the human condition, the muddle and the mystery of it, and in her hands, the meaning of it as well. Most women who write, myself included, abhor the term woman writer. But as the only woman paying tribute to her this evening, I cannot allow this opportunity to pass without saying how much I admire Mavis Gallant in this regard. In 1950, when she was 28, she walked away from the relatively steady paycheck of journalism and moved to Europe to try to live as a full-time fiction writer, and otherwise, in her own words, to destroy every scrap, every trace, every notebook, and live some other way. When I first learned this about her, I was astonished by her bravery and her ruthlessness. I have since learned that these are two qualities that every writer must always possess, in copious measure, in order to survive. Had I been in her shoes, I doubt that I could have treaded that high wire as fearlessly as she did. When Mavis Gallant was 30, she inhabited a world very different from mine, a world in which equality between the sexes was not taken for granted, a world in which respect for women had constantly to be earned. Far fewer women wrote back then, and the whole life cycle of books was largely the domain of men. The story of how she began writing and the countless stories she has written since fill me with utmost respect. She is an inspiration to me in every sense of the word.
That was the writer Jhumpa Lahiri talking on stage at Symphony Space about Mavis Gallant. Our program does not usually feature authors reading their own work, but this was an extraordinary event in so many ways. So here is Mavis Gallant now to read her own story, Greet and Push.
At an early hour, for the French man of letters, Henri Grippe, it was 8:45 on an April morning, he sat in a windowless brown-painted cubicle, facing a slight, mop-headed young man with horn-rimmed glasses and dimples. The man wore a dark tie with a narrow knot and a buttoned-up blazer. His signature was O Posh. His title, on the grubby, pulpy summons Grippe had read, sweating, was controller. He must be freshly out of his civil service training school, Grip guessed. Even his aspect of a priest hearing a confession a few yards from the guillotine seemed newly acquired. Before him lay open a dun-colored folder with not much in it, a letter from Grip full of delaying tactics, and copies of his correspondence with the bank in California. It was not true that American banks protected a depositor's secrets. Anyway, this one hadn't. Another reason Grip thought Opush must be recent was the way he kept blushing. He was not nearly as pale or as case-hardened as Grip. At this time, President de Gaulle had been in power 5 years. That would be about 1963 then. Two of which Grip had spent in blithe writer-in-residenceship in California. Returning to Paris, he had left a bank account behind. Now, it was forbidden then, under the Fifth Republic, for a French citizen to have a foreign account. The government might not have cared so much about drachmas or zlotys, but dollars were supposed to be scraped in, converted to francs at bottom rate, and, of course, counted as personal income. Grip's unwise and furtive moves with trifling sums, his somewhat paranoid disagreements with California over exchange, had finally caught the eye of the Bank of France, as a glistening minnow might attract a dozing whale. The whale swallowed Grip, found him too small to matter, and spat him out, straight into the path of a water ox called Public Treasury, Direct Taxation, Personal Income. That was Push. What Push had to discuss, a translation of Grip's novel, the one about the French teacher at the American University and his doomed love affair with his student Karen Sue, seemed to embarrass him. Observing Push with some curiosity, Grip saw, unreeling, scenes from the younger man's inhibited boyhood. He sensed, then discerned, the Catholic boarding school in bleakest Brittany, the unheated 40-bed dormitory, and nightly torment of unchaste dreams with astonishing partners, a daytime terror of real hell with real fire. "Human waywardness is hardly new," said Grip, feeling more secure now that he had tested Push and found him provincial. "It no longer shocks anyone." "Well, it was not the moral content of the book he wished to talk over," said Push, flaming. "In any case, he was not qualified to do so. He had flubbed philosophy and never taken modern French thought." "He must be new," Grip decided. He was babbling. Frankly, even though he had the figures in front of him, Push found it hard to believe the American translation of the novel had earned its author so little. There must be another considerable sum placed in some other bank. Perhaps Monsieur Grip could try to remember. The figures were true. The translation had done poorly. Failure played to Grip's advantage, reducing the hint of deliberate tax evasion to a simple oversight. Still, it hurt to have things put so plainly. He felt bound to tell Push that American readers were no longer interested in the teacher-student imbroglio, though there had been some slight curiosity as to what a foreigner might wring out of the old sponge. Push gazed at Grip. His eyes seemed to Grip as helpless and eager as those of a gun dog waiting for a command in the right language. Encouraged, Grip said more. In writing this novel, he had overlooked the essential development. The erring professor was supposed to come home at the end. He could be half dead, limping, on crutches, toothless, jobless, broke, impotent. It didn't matter. He had to be judged and shriven. As further modification, his wife, during his foolish affair, would have gone on to become a world-class cellist under her maiden name. Wife had not entered Grip's cast of characters, probably because, like Push, he did not have one. He had noticed Push did not wear a wedding ring. Grip's had just left his professor driving off to an airport in blessed weather, whistling a jaunty air. Pash shook his head. Obviously, it was not the language he was after. He began to write on a clean page of the file, taking no more notice of Greep. What a mistake it had been, Greep reflected, still feeling pain behind the scar, to have repeated the male teacher, female student pattern. He should have turned it around, identified himself with a brilliant and cynical woman teacher. Unfortunately, unlike Flaubert, his academic stalking horse, he could not put himself in a woman's place, probably because he thought it an absolutely terrible place to be. The novel had not done well in France either. Pash still had to get around to that. Paris critics had found Karen Sue's sociological context obscure. She seemed at a remove from events of her time, unaware of improved literacy figures in North Korea. Never once mentioned, or that since the advent of Gaullism, it cost 25 centimes to mail a letter. The pill was still unheard of in much of Europe. Readers could not understand what it was Karen Sue kept forgetting to take. Or why Grieps had devoted a contemplative no-action chapter to the abstract essence of risk. The professor had not given Karen Sue the cultural and political enlightenment one might have expected from the graduate of a preeminent Paris school. It was a banal story, really, about a pair of complacently bourgeois lovers. The real victim was Greep, seduced and abandoned by the American middle class. It was Greep's first outstanding debacle, and for that reason, the only one of his works he ever reread. He could still hear Karen Sue, the true, the original, making of every avowal a poignant question. I'm Karen Sue. I know you're busy. It's just that I don't understand what you said about Flaubert and his own niece. He recalled her with tolerance, the same tolerance that had probably weakened the book. Greep was wise enough to realize that the California bank affair had been an act of folly, a con man's aberration. He thought he could get away with it, knowing all the while he could not. There existed a deeper treasure for Pash to uncover, well below public treasury sites. Computers had not yet come into government use. Even typewriters were rare. Pash had summoned Greep in a cramped, almost secretive hand. It took time to strike an error, still longer to write a letter about it. In his youth, Greep had received from an American patroness of the arts 3 rent-bearing apartments in Paris, which he still owned. The patroness had been the last of a generous species, Greep one of the last young men to benefit from her kind. He collected the rents by devious and untraceable means, stowing the cash obtained in safe deposit. His visible way of life was stoic and plain. Not even the most vigilant controller could fault his underfurnished apartment in Montparnasse, shared with some cats he had already tried to claim as dependents. He showed none of the visible signs of prosperity public treasury seemed to like, such as membership in a golf club. Now, this is, by the way, not fiction. One's tax return some years ago had always the line, "Are you a member of a golf club?" And it's true. So this is the 60s, you see. So, well, after a few minutes of speculative anguish in the airless cubicle, Greep saw that Pash had no inkling whatever about the 3 flats. He was chasing something different, the inexistent royalties from the Karen Sue novel. By a sort of divine even-handedness, Greep was going to have to pay for imaginary earnings. He put the safe deposit out of his mind so it would not show in his face and said, "What will be left for me when you've finished adding and subtracting?" To his surprise, Pash replied in a bold tone, pitched for reciting quotations. Here's the quotation. "What is left? What is left? Only what remains at low tide when small islands are revealed, emerging, ... He stopped quoting and flushed. Obviously, he had committed the worst sort of blunder. He had been intimate, had let his own personality show. He had crossed over to his opponent's ground. It sounds familiar, said Greep, enticing him further, although to tell the truth, I don't remember writing it. Oh, it is a translation, said Posh, the Anglo-Saxon British author, Victor Prism. You've read Prism, said Greep, pronouncing correctly the name of an old acquaintance. I had to. Prism was on the preparatory program, Anglo-Saxon Commercial English. They stuffed you with foreign writers, said Gleep, with so many of us going to foreign lands for a living. Now that was Paris. He had just challenged Pusha's training, the very foundation of his right to sit there reading Grips's private mail. But he had suddenly recalled his dismay when, as a young man, he had looked at a shelf in his room and realized he had to compete with the dead. Proust, Flaubert, Balzac, Stendhal, and so on into the dark. The rivalry was infinite, a Milky Way of dead stars still daring to shine. He had invented a law, a moratorium on publication that would eliminate the dead, leaving the skies clear for the living. All the living? Greep still couldn't decide. Foreign writers would be deported to a remote solar system where they could circle one another. For Prism, there was no system sufficiently remote. Not so long ago, interviewed in The Listener, Victor Prism had dragged in Greep, saying that he used to cross the channel to consult a fortune teller in Half Moon Street, hurrying home to Paris to set down the prose revealed from a spirit universe. Sometimes I actually envied him, Prism was quoted as saying. He sounded as though Greeps were dead. I used to wish ghost voices would speak to me too, suggesting ribbons of pure prism running like ticker tape around the equator of a crystal ball. Unfortunately, I had to depend on my own creative intelligence, modest though I'm sure it was. Posh did not know about this recent libel in Anglo-Saxon Commercial English. He had been trying to be nice. Greep made a try of his own, jocular. Well, I only meant you could have been reading me. The trouble was he meant it ferociously. Posh must have heard a repressed shout. He shut the file and said, this dossier is too complex for my level. I shall have to send it up to the inspector. Greep made a vow he would never let natural pique get the better of him again. What will be left for me, Greep asked the inspector upstairs, when you have finished adding and subtracting? Madame Duppel did not bother to look up. She said, somebody should have taken this file in hand a long time ago. Let us start at the beginning. How long in all were you out of the country? When Posh said, send up, he'd meant it literally. Greep looked out on a church where Delacroix had worked and the slow summer rain. At the far end of the square, a few dark shops displayed joyfully trashy religious goods, like the cross set with tiny seashells Madame de Pelle wore round her neck. Greeps had been raised in an anti-clerical household in a small town where opposing factions were grouped behind the schoolmaster, Greeps' father, and the parish priest. Women, lapsed agnostics, sometimes crossed enemy lines and started going to church. One glimpsed them all in gray along the gray-walled street. Well, you are free to lodge a protest against the fine, said Madame de Pelle, but if you lose the contestation, your fine will be tripled. That is the law. Greep decided to transform Madame de Pelle into the manager of a brothel catering to this foreign legion, slovenly in her habits and addicted to chloroform. But he found the idea unpromising. In due course, he paid a monstrous penalty, which he did not contest, for fear of drawing attention to the three apartments. It was still believed he had stashed away millions from the Karen Sue book, probably in Switzerland. A summons addressed in old Posh's shrunken hand the following spring showed Greep he had been tossed back downstairs. After that, he forgot about Madame de Pelle, except now and then. It was at about this time that a series of novels offered themselves to Greep, shadowy outlines behind a frosted glass pane. He knew he must not let them crowd in altogether or keep them waiting too long. His foot against the door, he admitted, one by one, a number of shadows that turned into young men, each bringing his own name and address, his native region of France portrayed on color postcards, and an index of information about his taste in clothes, love, food, and philosophers, his bent of character, his tics of speech, his attitude toward God and money, his political bias, and the intimation of a crisis about to explode underfoot. Antoine provided a Jesuit confessor, a homosexual affinity, and loss of faith. Spiritual shilly-shallying tends to run long. Antoine's covered more than 600 pages, making it the thickest work in the Grip's canon. Then came Thomas with his Spartan mother on a Provençal fruit farm, which he rejected in favor of a civil service career. Bertrand followed, adrift in frivolous Paris, tempted by neo-fascism in the form of a woman wearing a bed jacket trimmed with marabou. René cycled around France reading Chateaubriand when he stopped to rest. One morning, he set fire to the barn he'd been sleeping in, leaving his books to burn. It was the shortest of the novels and the most popular with the young. One Paris critic scolded Grieb for using crude symbolism. Another begged him to stop hiding behind Antoine and René and take the metaphysical risk of revealing Henri. But Grieb had tried that once with Karen Sue, then with her roman à clé mercifully destroyed in the confusion of May 1968. He took these contretemps for a sign that he was to leave the subjective Grieb alone. The fact that each novel appeared, even to Grieb, to be a slice of French writing about life as it had been carved up and served a generation before made it seem quietly insurrectional. Nobody was doing this now, no one but Grieb. Grieb, for a time uneasy, decided to go on letting the shadows in. The announcement of a new publication would bring a summons from Push. When Push leaned over the file now, Grieb saw amid the mop of curls a coin-sized tonsure. His diffident, steely questions tried to elicit from Grieb how many copies were likely to be sold and where Grieb had already put the money. Grieb would give him a copy of the new book, inscribed. Posh would turn back the cover and glance at the signature to make sure Grieb had not written something compromising and friendly. He kept the novels in a metal locker, fastened together with government-issue webbing tape and military-looking buckle. It troubled Grieb to think that his work was all in a bundle in the dark. He thought of old-fashioned milestones, half-hidden by weeds, along disused roads. The volumes marked time for Push, too. He was still the controller. Perhaps he had to wait for the woman upstairs to retire so he could take over her title and office. His cubicle needed paint. There was a hole in the brown linoleum just inside the door. Push now wore a wedding ring. Grieb wondered if he should congratulate him, but decided to let Push mention the matter first. He tried to imagine Madame Push. Grieb could swear that in his string of novels, nothing had been chipped out of his own past. Antoine, Thomas, Bertrand, and René, and by now Clément, Didier, Laurent, Hugues, and Yves, had arrived as strangers, almost like historical figures. At the same time, it seemed to Grieb that their wavering, ruffled reflection should deliver something he alone could recognize. What did he see bending over the pond of his achievement? He saw a character close-mouthed, cautious, unimaginative, ill at ease, obsessed with particulars. Worse, he was closed against progress, afraid of reform, shut into a literary reactionary France. How could this be? Grieb had always and sincerely voted left. He had proved he could be reckless, open-minded, indulgent. He was like a father gazing round the breakfast table and suddenly realizing that none of the children are his. His children, if he could call them that, did not even look like him. From Antoine to Eve, his reflected character was small in sight, with a mop of curly hair, horn-rimmed glasses, and dimples. Grieb believed in the importance of errors. No political system, no love affair, no native inclination, no life itself would be tolerable without a wide mesh for mistakes to slip through. It pleased him that public treasury had never caught up with the three apartments, not just for the sake of the cash piling up in safe deposit, but for the black hole of error revealed. He and Push had been together for some years, another blunder. Usually controller and taxpayer were torn apart after a meeting or two, so that revenue service would not start taking into consideration the client's aged indigent aunt, his bill for dental surgery, his alimony payments, his perennial mortgage. But possibly no one except Posh could be bothered with Griep, always making some time-wasting claim for minute professional expenses backed by a messy-looking receipt. Sometimes Griep dared believe that Posh admired him, that he hung onto the dossier out of devotion to his books. This conceit was intensified when Posh began calling him mate. Once, Griep won some City of Paris award and was shown in François, shaking hands with the mayor and simultaneously receiving a long check-filled envelope. Immediately summoned by Posh, expecting a discreet compliment, Griep found him interested only in the caption under the photo, which made much of the size of the check. Griep later thought of sending a sneering letter, "Thank you for your warm congratulations," but he decided in time it was wiser not to fool with Posh. Posh had recently given him a 33% personal exemption for expenses, 3% more than the outer limit for Griep's category of earners, according to Posh, a group that included, as well as authors, door-to-door salesmen and prostitutes. The dun-colored Gaullist era jacket on Griep's file had worn out long ago and been replaced in 1969 by a cover in cool banker's green. Green presently made way for shiny black and white marbled effect, reflecting the mood of opulence of the early 70s. Called in for his annual springtime confession, Griep remarked about the folder, "Well, culture seems to have taken a decisive turn." Posh did not ask what culture. He continued bravely, "Food for the cats, mate, we can't." But they had already settled the cats' dependence question once and for all. Posh drooped over Griep's smudged and unreadable figures. Griep tried to count the number of times he'd examined the top of Posh's head. He still knew nothing about Posh except for the wedding ring. Somewhere along the way, Posh had tied himself to a need for retirement pay and rich exemplars of his own. In the language of his generation, Posh was a fully structured individual. His vocabulary was sparse and to the point, centered on a single topic. His state training school, the machine that ground out Pels and Posh's all sounding alike, was in Clermont-Ferrand. Griep was born in the same region. That might have given something to talk about. Except that Griep had never been back. Structured Posh probably attended class reunions, was godfather to classmates' children, jotted their birthdays in a leather-covered notebook he never mislaid. Unstructured Griep could not even remember his own age. Posh turned over a sheet of paper, read something Griep could not see, and said automatically, "No, we can't." "Nothing is ever as it was," said Griep, still going on about the marbled effect folder. It was a remark that usually shut people up, leaving them nowhere to go but a change of subject. Besides, it was true. Posh and Griep had just lost a terrifying number of brain cells. They were an instant closer to death. Death was of no interest to Posh. If he ever thought he might cease to exist, he would stop concentrating on other people's business and get down to reading Griep while there was still time. Griep wanted to ask, "Do you ever imagine your own funeral?" But it might have been taken as a threatening, gangsterish hint from taxpayer to controller, worse, far worse than an attempted bribe. A folder of a pretty mottled peach shade appeared. Posh's cubicle was painted a soft beige, the torn linoleum repaired. Posh sat in a comfortable armchair, resembling the wide leathery seats in smart furniture stores at the upper end of Boulevard Saint-Germain. Griep had a new, straight, metallic chair to sit in that shot him bolt upright and hurt his spine. It was the heyday of the Giscardian period when it seemed more important to keep the buttons polished than to watch where the regiment was heading. Griep and Posh had not advanced one inch toward each other. Except for the paint and the chairs and maître, it could have been 1963. No matter how many works were added to the bundle in the locker, no matter how often Grieb had his picture taken, no matter how many Grieb paperbacks blossomed on airport bookstalls, Grieb to Posh remained a button. The mottled peach jacket began to darken and fray. Posh said to Grieb, "I asked you to come here, Maître, because I find we have overlooked something concerning your income." Grieb's heart gave a lurch. "The other day I came across an old ruling about royalties. How much of your income do you kick back?" "Excuse me?" "To publishers, to bookstores," said Posh. "How much?" "Kick back?" "What percentage?" said Posh. "Publishers, printers." "You mean," said Grieb after a time, "how much do I pay editors to edit, publishers to publish, printers to print, and booksellers to sell?" He supposed that to Posh such a scheme might seem plausible. It would fit his long view over Grieb's untidy life. Grieb knew most of the literary gossip that went round about himself. The circle was so small it had to come back. In most stories, there was a virus of possibility, but he had never heard anything as absurd as this or as base. Posh opened the file, concealing the moldering cover, apparently waiting for Grieb to mention a figure. The nausea Grieb felt, he put down to having come here without breakfast. One does not insult a controller. He had shouted silently at Posh years before and had been sent upstairs to do penance with Madame de Pell. It is not good to kick over a chair and stalk out. "I have never been so insulted" might have no meaning from Grieb. Keelhauled month after month in one lumpy review or another. As his works increased from bundle to heap, so they drew intellectual abuse. He welcomed partisan ill-treatment as warming to him as popular praise. "Don't forget me," Grieb silently prayed, standing at the periodical tables in La Une, the Left Bank bookstore, looking for his own name in those quarterlies no one ever takes home. "Don't praise me. Praise is weak stuff. Praise me after I'm dead." But even the most sour and despairing and close-printed essays were starting to mutter acclaim. The shoreline of the 80s, barely in sight, was ready to welcome Grieb, who had reestablished the male as hero, whose left-wing heartbeat could be heard loyally thumping behind the armor of his right-wing traditional prose. His reestablished hero had curly hair, soft eyes, horn-rimmed glasses, and dimples, and a fully structured life. He was pleasing to both sexes and to every type of reader, except for a few thick-ribbed louts. Grieb looked back at Posh, who did not know how closely they were bound. What if he were to say, "This is a preposterous insinuation, a blot on a noble profession, and on my reputation in particular"? Only to have Posh answer, "Too bad, Maître, I was trying to help." So he said, as one good-natured fellow to another, "Well, what if I own up to this crime?" "Well, it's no crime," said Posh. "I simply add the amount to your professional expenses." "To my rebate," said Grieb, "to my exemption for expenses?" "Well, it depends on how much." "A third of my income," said Grieb insanely. "Wait. Half?" "Well, a reasonable figure might be 12.5%. All this for Grieb. Posh wanted nothing. Grieb considered with awe the only uncorruptible element in a porous society. No secret message had passed between them. He could not even invite Posh to lunch. He wondered if this arrangement had ever actually existed, if there could possibly be a good dodge that he, Grieb, had never heard of. He thought of contemporary authors for whose success there could be no other explanation. It had to be celestial playfulness or 12.5%. The structure, as Grieb was already calling it, might also just be Posh's innocent, indecent idea about writers. Posh was reading the file again, though he must have known everything in it by heart. He was as absorbed, as contented, and somehow as pure as a child with a box of paints. At any moment, he would raise his tender, bewildered eyes and murmur, 4 dozen typewriter ribbons in a third of the fiscal year, Maître, we can't." Grieb tried to compose a face for Posh to encounter, a face above reproach. But writers considered above reproach always look moody and haggard, about to scream. "Be careful," he was telling himself. "Don't let Posh think he's doing you a favor. These people set traps. Was Push angling for something? Was this bait, attempting to bribe a public servant, the accusation was called? Bribe wasn't the word, it was corruption, the law mentioned, an attempt to corrupt. All Greep had ever offered Push was his books, formally inscribed as though Push were anonymous readers standing in line in a bookstore, while Greeps, wedged behind a shaky table, sat signing away. Your name? Whose name? How do you spell your name? Oh, it's not for me, it's for a friend of mine. His look changed to one of severity and impatience until he remembered that Push had never asked him to sign anything. He had never concealed his purpose to plush from Greeps' plumage every bright feather he could find. Careful, Greeps repeated. Careful, remember what happened to Victor Prism. Victor Prism, keeping pale under a parasol on the beach at Torremolinos, had made the acquaintance of a fellow Englishman, pleasant, not well-educated but eager to learn, blistered shoulders, shirt draped over his head, pages of the Sunday Express round his reddening thighs. Prism had lent him something to read. His sunburn was keeping him awake. It was a creative essay of Prism's on three emigre authors of the 1930s, in a review so obscure and ill-paying that Prism had not bothered to include the fee on his income tax return. Prism had got it wrong, of course, having Thomas Mann, whose plain name Prism could not spell, go to East Germany and with his wife start a theater that presented his own plays, sending Stefan Zweig to be photographed with movie stars in California, and putting Bertolt Brecht to die a bitter man in self-imposed exile in Brazil. As it turned out, none of Prism's readers knew the difference. Chided by Grieb, Prism had been defensive, cold, said that no letters had come in. Oh, one surely, said Grieb. Yes, I thought that was you, Prism said. Prism might have got off with the whole thing if his new friend had not fallen sound asleep after the first lines. Waking, refreshed, he had said to himself, I must find out what they get paid for this stuff. A natural reflex, he was of the Inland Revenue. He'd found no trace, no record for Inland Revenue purposes. Death in Exile, that's the name of the essay, did not exist. The subsequent fine was so heavy and Prism's disgrace so acute that he fled England to spend a few days with Grips in Montparnasse. He sat on a kitchen chair while Grip, nose and mouth protected by a checked scarf, sprayed terror to cockroaches. Prism, weeping in the fumes and wiping his eyes, said, I'm through with Queen and Country, something like that, and I'm taking out French citizenship tomorrow. You would have to marry a French woman and have at least 5 male children, said Grip. Through the scarf. He was feeling the patriotic hatred of a driver on a crowded road seeing foreign license plates in the way. Oh, well then, said Prism, as if to say, I won't bother. Oh, well then, said Greep softly, not quite to Push. Push now added one last thing to the file and closed it, as if something definite had taken place. He clasped his hands and placed them on the dossier. It seemed shut for all time now, like a grave. He said, Maître, one never stays long in the same fiscal theater. I have been in this one for an unusual length of time. We may never meet again. I want you to know I have enjoyed our conversations. So have I, said Grieb with caution. Much of your autobiographical creation could apply to other lives of our time, believe me. So you have read them, said Grieb, an eye on the locker. I read those I bought, said Push. But they are the same books. No, the books I bought belong to me. The others were gifts. I would never open a gift. I have no right to. His voice rose and he spoke more slowly. In one of them, when what's-his-name struggles to prepare his civil service tests, he quotes, the desire for individual glory seemed so inapposite, suddenly in a nature given to renunciation. I suppose it is a remarkable observation, said Grieb. I was not referring to myself. He had no idea what it could be from, and he was certain he'd never written it. Push did not send for Grieb again. Grieb became a commonplace taxpayer, filling out his forms without help. The frosted glass door was reverting to dull white. There were fewer shadows for Grieb to let in. a fashion for having well-behaved Nazi officers shore up Western culture, gave Grieb a chance to turn Posch into a tubercular poet trapped in Paris by poverty and the occupation. Grieb threw out the first draft, in which Posch joined a Christian-minded resistance network and performed a few simple miracles, unaware of his own powers. He had the instinctive feeling that a new generation would not know what he was talking about. Instead, he placed Posch, sniffling and wheezing, in a squalid hotel room, cough drops spilled on the table, a stained blanket pinned round his shoulders. Up the fetid staircase came a handsome colonel, a Kurt Jurgens type, smelling of shaving lotion, bent on saving literal values, bringing Posch butter, cognac, and 1,000 sheets of paper. After that, Grieb no longer felt sure where to go. His earlier books, government tape and buckle binding them into an oeuvre, had accompanied Posch to his new fiscal theatre. Perhaps, finding his career blocked by the woman upstairs, Posch had asked for early retirement. Perhaps Posch was in a gangster-ridden Mediterranean city, occupying a shoddy boom-period apartment he'd spent 20 years paying for. He was working at a black market job, tax advisor to the local mayor, a small innocent cog in the regional mafia. After lunch, Posch would sit on one of those southern balconies that hold just one deck chair, rereading in chronological order all Grieb's books. In the late afternoon, blinds drawn, Posch totted up mafia accounts by a chink of light. Grieb was here in Montparnasse, facing a flat white glass door. He continued to hand himself a 45.5% personal exemption, the astonishing 33 plus the unheard of 12.5. No one seemed to mind. No shabby envelope holding an order for execution came in the mail. Sometimes, in Grieb's mind, a flicker of common sense flamed like a revealed truth. The exemption was an error. Public treasury was now tiptoeing toward computers. The computer brain was bound to wince at Grieb and stop functioning until the Grieb exemption was settled. Grieb rehearsed, saying, "I was seriously misinformed." He had to go farther and farther abroad now to find offal for his cats. One tripe dealer had been turned into a driving school. Another sold secondhand clothes. Returning on a winter evening, after a long walk, carrying a parcel of sheep's lung wrapped in newspaper, he crossed Boulevard du Montparnasse just as the street lights went on, the urban moonrise. The street was a dream street, faces flat white in the winter mist. It seemed to Grieb that he had crossed over the 1980s, had only just noticed the new decade. In a recess between two glassed-in sidewalk cafes, four plainclothes cops were beating up a pair of pickpockets. Nobody had to explain the scene to Grieb. He knew what it was about. One prisoner already wore handcuffs. Customers on the far side of the glass gave no more than a glance. When they had got handcuffs on the second man, the cops pushed the two into the entrance of Grieb's apartment building to wait for the police van. Grieb shuffled into a cafe. He put his parcel on the zinc-top bar and started to read an article on the newspaper wrapping. Someone unknown to him, a new name, pursued an old grievance. Why don't they write about real life anymore? "Because to depict life is to attract its ill fortune," Grieb replied. He stood sipping coffee, staring at nothing. Four gun-bearing young men in jeans and leather jackets were not final authority. Final authority was something written, the printed word, even when the word was mistaken. The simplest final authority in Grieb's life had been O. Posch and a book of rules. What must have happened was this. Posch, wishing to do honor to a category that included writers, prostitutes, and door-to-door salesmen, had read and misunderstood a note about royalties. It had been in italics at the foot of a page. He had transformed his mistake into a regulation and never looked at the page again. Grieb, in imagination, climbed three flights of dirty wooden stairs to Madame de Pell's office. He observed the seashell crucifix in a brooch he had not noticed the first time, a silver fawn curled up as nature had never planned. Squinting, Madame de Pell peered at the old dun-colored dualist era file. She put her hand over a page as though Greek were trying to read upside down. "It has all got to be paid back," she said. "I was seriously misinformed," Greep intended to answer, willing to see posh, disgraced, ruined, jailed. "I followed instructions. I am innocent." But posh had vanished, leaving Greep with a lunatic exemption, 3 black market income-bearing apartments he had recently unsuccessfully tried to sell, and a heavy reputation for male-oriented, left-feeling, right-thinking books. This reputation Greep thought he could no longer sustain. A socialist government was at last in place. This would be 1981. Hence his hurry about unloading the flats and his difficulty in finding takers. He wondered about the new file cover. Would it be pink? Too fragile. Look what had happened with the mottled peach. Strong denim blue, a shade standing for Giovinezza and workers' overalls. It was no time for a joke, not even a private one. No one could guess now it would be wanted, now, in the way of literary entertainment. The fitfulness of voters is such that having got the government they wanted, they were now reading nothing but the right-wing press. Perhaps a steady right-wing heartbeat ought to set the cadence for a left-wing outlook, with a complex, bravely conservative heroine contained within the slippery but unyielding walls of left-wing style. He would have to come to terms with the rightist way of considering female characters. There seemed to be 2 methods, neither of which suited Gripsis' temperament. Treat her disgustingly and cry all over the page, or admire and respect her. She is the equal, at least, of a horse. The only woman his imagination offered, with some insistence, was no use to him. She moved quietly in a winter evening to Saint Nicolas du Chardonnay, the rebel church at the lower end of Boulevard Saint-Germain, where services were still conducted in Latin. This was a rebel church, and they were all excommunicated at the time. She wore a hat ornamented with an ivory arrow and a plain gray coat, tubular in shape, with a narrow collar. Kid gloves were tucked under the handle of her sturdy leather purse. She had never heard of video games, dishwashers, filleted sole, frozen, computer horoscopes. She entered the church and knelt down and brought out her rosary, oval pearls strung on thin gold. Nobody saw rosaries anymore. They were not even in the windows of their traditional venues across the square from the tax bureau. Believers went in now for different articles, cherub candles, quick prayers on plastic cards. Her iron meekness resisted change. She prayed constantly into the past. Greep knew that one's view of the past is just as misleading as speculation about the future. It was one of the few beliefs he would have gone to the stake for. She was praying into a mist, to mist-shrouded figures. She persisted in seeing Claire. He could see the woman, but he could not approach her. Perhaps he could get away with dealing with her from a distance. All that was really needed for a sturdy right-wing novel was its pessimistic rhythm. And then, and then, and then, and death. Greeps had that rhythm. It was in his footsteps, coming up the stairs after the departure of the police van, turning the key in his triple-bolted front door. And then, the cats padding and mewing, not giving Greep time to take his coat off as they made for their empty dishes in the kitchen floor. Behind the gas stove, a beleaguered garrison of cockroaches got ready for the evening sortie. Greep would be waiting, his face half veiled with a scarf. In Saint-Nicolas du Chardonnay, the woman shut her missal, got up off her knees, scorning to brush her coat. She went out toward the street, proud of the dust marks, letting the world know she still prayed the old way. She escaped him. He had no idea what she had on besides the hat and coat. Nobody else wore a hat with an ivory arrow or a tubular coat or a scarf that looked like a weasel biting its tail. He could not see what happened when she took the hat and coat off, what her hair was like, if she hung the coat in a hall closet that contained umbrellas, a carpet sweeper, and a pile of old magazines, if she put the hat in a round box in a shelf. She moved off in a gray blur. There was a streaming window between them Greep could not wipe clean. Probably she entered a dark dining room with a fake Renaissance buffet, bottles of pills next to the oil and vinegar cruets, lace tablecloth folded over the back of a chair, just oilcloth spread for the evening meal. What could he do with such a woman? He could not tell who was waiting for her or what she would eat for supper. He could not even guess her name. She revealed nothing. She would never help. Greep expelled the cats, shut the kitchen window, and dealt with the advance guard from behind the stove. What he needed now was despair and excitement, a new cat and mouse chase. What good was a computer that never caught anyone out? After airing the kitchen and clearing it of poison, Greep let the cats in. He swept up the bodies of his victims and sent them down the ancient cast iron chute. He began to talk to himself, as he often did now. First, he said a few sensible things. Then he heard his voice with a new elderly quaver to it, virtuous and mean. After all, it doesn't take much to keep me happy. Now, that was untrue, and he had no reason to say it. Is that what I'm going to be like now, he wondered? Is this the new era, Greep, Pinchmouth? It was exactly the sort of thing that the woman in the dark dining room might say. The best thing that could happen to him would be a shock, a siege of terror, a knock at the door, and a registered letter with fearful news. It would sharpen his humor, strengthen his own private, eccentric heart. It would keep him from making remarks in his solitude that were meaningless and false. He could perhaps write an anonymous letter saying that the famous author Henri Grip was guilty of evasion of a most repulsive kind. He was, moreover, a callous landlord who had never been known to replace a doorknob. Fortunately, he saw he was not yet that mad, nor did he really need to be scared and obsessed. He had got the woman from church to dining room, and he would keep her there, trapped, cornered, threatened, watched, until she yielded to Grip and told her name, as in his several incarnations, good Posh had always done.
Mavis Gallant reading her story, Greep and Push. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Rob Christensen. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC New York Public Radio and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.